call this meeting of the Free Conference Committee on Senate Bill 89 to order. It's looks like it's about 1:18. President Senator Coghill, Begich, and Representative Klayman, Tuck, and Pruitt. See any other legislators here joining us? So the only order of business today is taking up Senate Bill 89, an act relating to the Legislative Ethics Act and providing for an effective date. The Free Conference Committee on Senate Bill 89 will be operating under Uniform Rule 42. Conference and Free Conference Committees, A, suspended, little a. The uniform rules were waived, and the Conference Committee has been granted the powers of Free Conference, which gives this Conference Committee the ability to consider all issues that are germane to the title of the bill before the committee. Probably not done lightly. And so, Mr. Klayman, I'll explain. I'm sorry, Mr. Klayman, you get to read that part, and then I'm going to get to Mr. Hutchison.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Senator Coghill. The leadership as it applies to the committee, Senator Coghill will chair the meeting since the bill originated as a Senate bill.
Thank you. And so that everybody understands kind of what we're doing, I'm going to have Chad Hutchison give a section by section on the comparison between the Senate and the House versions of the bill. So, Mr. Hutchison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Chad Hutchison, and the relevant document is going to be the comparison sheet. It's the Senate Bill 89 comparison sheet related to the Legislative Ethics Act revisions that have occurred. And I'm going to go through and talk about what the ultimate conclusion was, which is version G, which is what you should have in front of you, and then talk about the version that passed the Senate, which was version K, the version that passed the House, which was version E, and then finally what's been settled upon, or has been proposed to be settled upon, version G. So on page one of the comparison sheet, the first section that we're going to be looking at in version.
Yeah, just a minute. Well, I want to make sure everybody gets them. I don't have mine, so let's just take
copies. Might be in your green folder there.
It probably is, yeah. I've got three.
I have another copy of those. So.
All right, this wasn't labeled for me, that's all right. But if it was, I didn't see it, which is not unusual for a guy that's going blind. All right, you ready? Go back on? So, yeah, we're on. Sorry about that, Mr. Hutchison. I had the paper. I just didn't know where I had it. So, please continue.
Okay, so we're looking on page one. This is section one of version G, and it has to deal with legislative intent language. In version K, the Senate bill, that language did not exist. In version E, the House bill, that language was added by Representative Klayman, and it said that there has to be a fair and open government, and that requires unencumbered access to legislators pursuant to Article 1, Sections 5 and 6, which are the freedom of speech and freedom to assemble and petition in the state constitution. The ultimate conclusion with version G was that the language that the House amended was kept in the final version of SB 89. On section 2, now we're going into one of the substantive parts of the bill. We're talking about prohibitions on official and or legislative action, and you'll see that there's been a revision there that's important to note, and we'll talk about that. In version K, the Senate bill, all we simply did was go back to the way things existed prior to HB 44. So we went back to the way they existed prior to 2018. There was a change in the House version E, and that added the legislator's spouse, specifically it said, or the legislator's spouse is employed or negotiating for employment. So the emphasis was on the legislator's spouse. We want to make sure that was included. Now, in version G, there was a number of changes made, and that was done after a meeting of the minds and an appetite for clarity. And number one, the first thing that was changed was official action. Official action has not been defined. The Legislative Ethics Committee has had to make do with the definition of legislative action, which occurs in AS 2469-90-10. And legislative action includes, and I'll read it for you, it means conduct related to the development, drafting, consideration, sponsorship, enactment or defeat, support or opposition to or of a law, amendment, resolution, report, nomination, or other matter affected by legislative action or inaction. And for the purposes of clarity, it was decided that if we're going to make
on the record. Sorry about that. We had a little glitch in the technical system there. So,
very good, Mr. Chair. So I'm on Section 2 of Version G. We explained that the decision was made to replace official action with legislative action, which has previously been defined, and I read that definition. And the intent there is to bring more clarity both to the Ethics Committee and to the ethics advisors like Jerry Anderson as they go through the process and explain what can and cannot occur with regards to legislative action. The intent is to use the previously defined words that provide extra clarity. So the second change that was made with regards to Section 2 is that could is being replaced by is likely to. And if you look at the bullet points that were prepared, is likely to, the definition is also intended to mean, this is for the purposes of the Ethics Committee as it reviews some of the cases that will come before it, but likely is meant to be more likely than not. In other words, a greater than 50% chance. So that's what likely means in that context. Number three, the change that was made in Section 2 of Version G.
Can I just ask a question about that?
Yes, sir, please.
Chairman? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I'm curious about is that also defined then? Is that defined legislatively, or is this just the definition in the notes? I really, by the way, value the notes. They're very useful. So,
Senator Begich, through the chair, so the answer is that we use the preponderance of the evidence threshold that's used in civil proceedings, and likely is often, more likely than not, it's anything greater than 50% chance. That's what we took it to mean.
So, thank you.
And just for those on the committee and those watching, this has to do with the section that is the prohibition section. There is what a legislator cannot do, and then the next section, Section 3, deals with how you must declare that conflict. And the reason we're here to begin with is in Senate Bill 44, House Bill 44, the definitions were connected to both sections, and we found out as we were going through this that was not the case under the way we drafted it. So that's hence the free conference committee. We had to tie those definitions together, and so it's tying them together and cleaning them up so that they're cogent on both sides. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the third change that was made in Section 2 of Version G is that legislative action is only barred if the legislation is likely to, quote, substantially benefit or harm the, and quote again, financial interests, which have been given clear definitions, and we'll see that a little bit later in Version G. But the intent was to sync everything up and to give definitive parameters as to what substantially benefit or harm means and what financial interest means. But the fourth change that you see in Section 2 is that another was clarified to mean the legislator or the legislator's spouse. And that was chosen over the previous definition in HB 44, which included immediate family, which was considered to be too broad for tax purposes. The spouse and the legislature, there's some synergy there, and so that was what was determined to be the best balance. So Section 3 of Version G is the declarations of conflict. That existed in Section 2 of Version K that came out of the Senate. And what the Senate version said was that conflict should be declared in the committee process on the floor, and that conflict should be declared if there's an equity or ownership interest instead of a financial interest, and the conflicts are compared with a substantial class of persons rather than the general public. So there was a change. The general public was considered to be too broad. It would affect entire industries and was prohibitive with regards to a lot of legislative action that some senators and some representatives wanted to partake in this year. So those changes were made. Those were kept in version E, which was the House bill, with the exception of they also added the legislator's spouse. In version G, there is a little bit of a revision, and what was ultimately determined was that conflict shall be declared in the committee process and on the floor if the effect of the vote is likely to substantially benefit or harm the financial interests of the legislator or legislator's spouse. And the intent there is to sync the definitions, the language that exists, so it's all simpatico. We want to make sure that there's the least amount of confusion as it relates to interpretations that might come out of the Ethics Committee, and so we're trying to give them good directions there. An important key distinction that was added was that employment was also included in addition to negotiating for employment, so current employment or negotiating for employment. So they thought that that was a good balance in the grand scheme of things. So Section 4 of Version G talks about definitions. In the Senate version, both proposed definitions were repealed, and it just went back to the way things existed prior to HB 44. And you can see on the document on page 2, Version K, what those definitions were. The same thing occurred on Version E, the House bill, which appears in Section 4 of that bill. And then in Section 4 of Version G, there is a revision as to what the actual definition is for 030J2, and it's noteworthy that 990A6 is still repealed. It just occurs later on in version G. So here's the new definition for 2460-030J2. It's amended to read that it has to read substantially benefit or harm means the effect on a person's financial interest is greater than the effect on the financial interest of a substantial class of persons to which the person belongs as a member of a profession, occupation, industry, or region. And the intent there is you're trying to eliminate personal enrichment and a personal benefit to a specific company to the detriment of the rest of the industry. You don't want a scenario where company A, the legislator works for company A, there's a piece of legislation that benefits company A to the detriment of everybody else. There has to be, if you're going to present language in a bill, it's okay if the entire industry can benefit, but you can't have specific legislation that benefits your specific company or entity to the detriment of everybody else. So they felt like this was the best language and created the best balance. 990A6, it is still...
When he says they, it was legislators plus working together with Dan Wayne.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. To clarify, that's correct. It was working with Ledge Legal and legislators. There was a meeting of the minds on that. So 990A6 is still repealed, and we will see that in a few moments here as we flip through onto page 3 of the comparison sheet. So on Section 5, definitions, this is the revised definition of financial interest. It did not exist in version K or version E, the House or Senate bills. It does exist in version G, and it essentially says that J3 states that financial interest means a substantial equity or business interest in a business, investment, real property, lease, or other enterprise. The intent is to sync language to make the interpretation more clear. That's a direction to the Ethics Committee. And then you will see in Section 6 of Version G, this is the part that I mentioned earlier, that 990A6 has been repealed, and that's And that's the current status. So Section 7 of Version G, it's just the effective date, and the effective date is effective immediately. And with that, Mr. Chairman, that is the comparison sheet for all versions of the bills and some explanation as to why we settled on language in Version G, the version you see before you.
So as you can see, members of the committee, that's one of the reasons why a free conference was granted, because there was a bunch of new language that was not in both bills. But it was trying to keep it simple, keep it clarified, that when you have a real conflict of interest, there are some prohibitions and some requirements for you to declare them. And this gives us probably a better definition than we had before. Plus, it carries continuity between the prohibition language and the declaration requirement. So it syncs them up so that there's a congruity of understanding on both of them, which there wasn't before, either in our existing law or in House Bill 44 or in the versions that we tried to put forward that we thought we were. So is there any discussion? So we'll go down to Senator Tuck and then Senator Pruitt.
Representative.
Oh, they haven't been from everybody's a senator in my mind, so sorry. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what we're trying to do, I just want to just stay real quick, is we're trying to fix some problems that some unintended consequences as a result of House Bill 44. And I think that one of the biggest problems that we had with that was the definition, not having a definition of official action and official influence. And my understanding as it went through State Affairs was to require someone to declare a conflict and to prevent them from voting if a conflict then exists, both on in committee and on the floor. However, the resolution that went along with that to happen on the floor did not pass. And so then when we go into looking at official action, the only definition that Ledge Ethics can refer to is, you know, what does that mean when there is inquiries on what are the new requirements in different scenarios, and as we were trying to come up with advisory opinions, the only thing that we can lean on was the definition of legislative action, which is drafting a bill, talking with constituents, talking in public, meeting one-on-one with other legislators, caucus meetings, and so on and so forth. And so that really puts some restrictions on everybody's ability to just even maneuver without fear of having a conflict. And I just want to point out that our beginning of our Ledge Ethics statutes basically says that the legislature finds that high moral and ethical standards among public servants in the legislative branch of government are essential to assure the trust, respect, and confidence of the people of the state. And a fair and open government requires that legislators and legislative employees conduct the public's business in a manner that preserves the integrity of the legislature and the legislative process and avoids conflicts of interest or even appearances of conflicts of interest. And then it goes on, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it goes on basically to state that you can't solve everything.
Right.
You know, and that's I think that the best that we can do is the best that we can do. So as we go through this, keeping that in mind, I see a couple of things that we've done is we've removed official influence. So that helps out there, and I've always had a problem with that too, official influence. I guess my question on this one is if when someone's presenting a bill to the legislature with the new version G, if they have a conflict of interest, is there any limitation of them being able to draft or present a bill, or will there be limitations on someone being able to do that if they have a conflict of interest?
Representative Tuck, to the chair, they are prohibited. So if I can direct you to the bullet points, answer 4, they are prohibited from taking legislative action if these 3 things line up, which is in circumstances where legislative action is likely to substantially benefit or harm the financial interests of a legislator, legislator's spouse, or a person with whom the legislator or legislator's spouse is employed for, or is negotiating for employment, they are prohibited from taking legislative action. So you have to go through a three-step analysis. Number one, is it likely? So is it more likely than not? That's the 50%, over 50% threshold that you have to determine. Is there more? Is it more likely than not there's going to be a substantial benefit or harm to the financial interests of the legislature? So likely, is it a higher probability of 50% to substantially benefit or harm? So substantially benefit or harm is the effect on a person's financial interest is greater than the effect on the financial interest of a substantial class of persons to which that person belongs, a member of a profession, occupation, industry, or region. So if the answer is that there's a higher probability that their specific conflict, whether it be there's the example that was given here, and I'll just read it onto the record, is that if legislator A works for company A in a statewide industry, other companies are also in the industry, including companies B, C, D, E, F, and G, a substantial benefit occurs when company A greatly benefits, but there is no benefit to companies B, C, D, E, F, and G. There is no substantial benefit if all companies, so that's including A, benefit because of an equal policy that benefits the entire industry, if in reality the benefit from one company to company varies. So if they all get a 4% rate and everybody, the rising tide floats all ships, then that's fine. It's only when that specific targeted company receives a benefit that the legislator or the legislator's spouse is employed or negotiating for employment, then that's prohibited conduct. That's the narrow focus that we're trying to ensure, the personal enrichment. We're trying to ensure that they don't get the benefit to the detriment of everybody else. So that's the second part of it.
May I add, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, and I'm going to interrupt here in a minute. 20-minute answers are going to be tougher because all you do, we're just going to add more questions to it. But Senator Biggs, and then I've got another announcement to make.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to give a real-world example based on what you just said. I realized under the current ethics law I had a conflict of interest because my wife works for an organization that has a number of school districts engaged with it. It's unclear whether she would have materially benefited or not by me supporting early funding of education in a constitutional amendment, but it could have. Under this language that you've proposed, that actually would not happen. I could, in fact, co-sponsor because early funding, while it would affect those school districts, would affect all school districts. And so I would then be able to co-sponsor that legislation because it doesn't materially impact her. That would be correct under this interpretation.
Senator Biggs, that is correct.
So
the other announcement I have to make is I just got notice from Aneva that the version G was the draft, and the newest version is what, Aneva?
O.
It's the O. Exactly the same language, exactly the same. It's just that a final version, I guess, that needs to be before us before we make a motion, I can tell you that. So you want to take a minute to just double-check that?
Yeah.
Let's take a brief. It is. Just for the, we're back on order. Just for the information of those watching us, what we had here was a draft that had not had the free conference language title in it because the House had to appoint their members before that could be drafted. So This is the version O, so it's exactly the same as the version G that you made your notes on. It's just now it says free conference CS. So just for what it's worth for everybody. Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Senator. So just trying to understand one, I think I understand pretty much for most bills, but the one I guess I have a question on is recently in terms of the appropriations bill, the budget in the case that just moved through the House, determination was that there was not a conflict. There was not a conflict that was needed to be declared because I can't even remember the details of why the speaker indicated that that was the case. I guess in terms of what we have in front of us, the bill that's in front of us, do we eliminate that need, or is it? Do we even clarify the need where there's not the ambiguity in terms of an appropriations bill, specifically an operating or capital budget, where a conflict would need to be declared, or are we still in kind of this? I guess it's almost an uncertain state. He made a ruling, but you know I want to make sure that the ruling doesn't come back and people unfortunately find themselves in trouble later on. Does this help with that?
Let me start because the House Bill 44 language actually exempted the votes on the budget.
Got it.
So what we've done is taken that part out, but it had to be the substantial interest, and then we can go on to Mr. Hutchison has to say. Chairman Kleeman.
So Representative Pruitt, if you turn to page 3 of the O version, and you look at lines 3 through 6, you'll see those in the capitalized letters. That's the language that the speaker referred to about why we don't have to declare conflicts on the floor on a budget bill. That's being removed by this particular version. It's on page 3, lines 3 through 6, starts out at the end of line 3. However, notwithstanding E3 of this section and the limitations of this subsection, the legislator may vote on an appropriation bill that meets the requirements of AS 3707-20A and 3707-100. So we'd be back in kind of the old style on the floor, for lack of a better description.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think that I believe that actually answers the question. I don't know if Mr. Hutchison has anything to add, but.
All right, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that, my only concern with I've never seen anyone vote on an appropriations bill where they had to be refrained from voting on an appropriations bill when they declared a conflict. I just never seen it. And because the budget is so encompassing that almost anyone can have a conflict with the budget bill. I mean, especially when you put the permanent fund dividend in there. So I don't know why we would want to take that out. And the reason why I say so is there's been some rulings on the floor that I feel a little bit uncomfortable with, and that's when, for the purposes of anyone that has a conflict, you're going to be required to vote. To make that blanket statement to the whole legislative body, I think is doing a disservice for those that really should be declaring, because you can't rule ahead of time of somebody's declaration that you're going to be required to vote. Well, you can go ahead and say, hey, I'm going to object to anybody who declares, but a person still needs to put on record their declaration. So if we want to still continue doing that, I'm okay with it. But I have a problem when someone makes a blanket, because whether someone says, hey, if you have a conflict, I'm going to go ahead and rule that you have to vote, sure, but I'm still going to declare that conflict. But I think in making that announcement, what's happening is people are not declaring those conflicts, and I still think that needs to be on record, or we put this section back in.
I think the substantial class of persons definitely answers that, but I don't know that you'll ever stop people from standing up and asking to be excused from voting for a variety of reasons, but it's left to the body to discern at that point, and if somebody feels strongly about it, you know. So, but my guess is the substantial class of individual, the substantial benefit of the broad class, plus the financial interest of legislators at stake. I don't see where that comes to being on a broad tax bill, whether it's education funding or right down to bridge building, you know. So, but I don't know that you're going to stop people from actually standing up saying, I don't want to vote for this because, and then declare their conflict. That's totally within the realm. This just says there has to be a more substantial reason than a perceived conflict. And so, Mr. Klayman, Representative Klayman, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just add, Representative Tuck, I actually, after having been here for 4 years when people declared conflicts and then this new rule suggests we didn't have to declare conflicts, I actually found myself liking the old style where we actually said, you know, my wife works for such and such and I have a conflict, or when I'm not here in session, I work for somebody else and I want to declare a conflict. I think it's useful to do that. And so rather than put the language back in, I like your suggestion that we should keep it out, but recognize everybody's going to have to stand up and declare their conflict. I'd also note that, interestingly enough, where this appears, which probably would lead to even more confusion, this subsection, which is in subsection E of the bill, that relates to legislative action, but not necessarily voting on the floor. And when you look at subsection G, they didn't have that provision in the provisions about votes on the floor and votes on committees. That wasn't in there in the existing statute. So I think taking it out completely just means you got to declare your conflicts. And I think that's a more appropriate way to go forward.
Further discussion?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would actually agree with you on that one, Matt. And I would rather, you know, the public doesn't know what's going on most of the time, so our ability to disclose as opposed to not disclosing makes more sense to me. And to not have to disclose on the budget, which is what the old law did, was actually less beneficial to the public. Having to disclose seems to me to be more beneficial. It might take a little extra time, but the public deserves to know if there's conflict. And if you don't disclose, they deserve to know that if that's discovered and you actually did have a substantive conflict because you built that bridge to your property and nobody else was there. So I think this is a good idea that it's left out.
And if I may, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead. Well, Representative Pruitt, and then we'll get back to you.
Yeah, no, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think kind of one of the points that the Representative Tuck was bringing up, which I think is actually absolutely vital, is sometimes when we declare these conflicts, sometimes it can seem like it's annoying. Because if you have 15 different people that stand up, and sometimes there's this idea of, well, no, people are going to have conflicts. And I think that may have been partly where Representative Tuck was coming from. What we don't want to do is we don't want to wash over that if there's 15 people with a conflict on an appropriation bill, then all 15 people should stand up. It's not something that we want to just brush over. There can't be, and this is a great time to state our legislative intent, especially with two members of the Ethics Committee sitting here, is that it should be, I think the idea is that we, if in the effort to declare that we want to see transparency, we can't just be, well, this is annoying because a bunch of people are going to stand up. That the intent is that a ruling should be that if you've got a declaration, you're going to declare it, and then of course the body can determine. And every single person that feels they have that declaration can and should. You don't make a blanket comment at the beginning saying that, you know, I get it, some people are going to have some conflicts, and therefore we will. They won't need to declare it. And I, in that case, I wholeheartedly agree. I think that transparency in this particular case would be what we were seeking.
Yeah, no, and I agree with that. My main concern, because we had rules chairs in the past that has said to everybody, hey, if you have a conflict, you know, boom, which I'm glad that Representative Max Gruenberg caught when somebody had a conflict, and even though this person did not declare it, he called them at ease right away because they didn't think they needed to declare it because of the statement that the rules chair made. And so what I want to do is make sure that does not happen, that anyone has a – you know what would be good, maybe, process-wise, is when someone declares a conflict on that particular item, whatever it happens to be, whether it's an amendment or something else or a main motion, that someone stands up, declares a conflict, and then – the speaker or the presiding officer says, does anyone else have that same conflict? And then have them all raise their hands and then say, okay, well, all you guys are going to be, that way everyone can, at least by show of hands or some method, show that they have the same conflict to keep things moving. Because I understand the frustration that people end up with so many declarations happening. And people are siding on the error of safety when they do that. We had one representative that did not declare, and, you know, they paid a penalty for that.
Well, I think all of this is going to be instructive for all of us and for the presiding officers watching, because it is a motion. It shouldn't be just stand up and make a declaration. It should be properly stated as a motion and the reason why the conflict exists, and ask for the excuse to be the ask for the excuse of the vote. And so we just got to get ourselves parliamentary a little cleaner in this, and I think this bill helps us get there, but the whole conversation has actually helped us get there. This just makes it more clear when it's a real conflict, when you have prohibited action, and when you're required to make sure that you're stating it. But you can always err on the side of a perceived conflict. I think that's still wise. So, other discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So just to make sure I understand correctly, and I know your staff went with a lengthy answer, but to try to simplify it, if anyone has a conflict, they can't take any of those legislative actions that are written by definition. Is that my understanding on the prohibition if somebody has a conflict?
Mr. Chairman, I think I can actually answer that.
Sure. Let's start with Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the answer is because we've changed the definition and made that definition more clear, the answer to your question is yes, but actions that were prohibited before are not any longer prohibited. So, for example, and correct me if I'm wrong on this one, Chad, but for example, I could choose to sponsor a piece of legislation as long as it didn't materially benefit specifically my spouse or myself, an employer of my spouse or myself, more likely to benefit, using that language. And so prohibitions that were blanket before under the undefined and loose definition no longer exist, but you can do it. Yes, you can do it now, but you can't do it if it's specifically the legislative action can't be taken specifically, it's more likely to benefit you. Would that be correct, Jack?
Senator Begich, through the chair, that is correct. It's that three-step analysis. Is it likely? Is it a substantial benefit or harm? And the financial interest, which is ownership or equity interests. Is it? So as long as you go through that stepped analysis, that's what you're going to be looking at. And it should be, it's noteworthy that conflicts are always declared in the committee process too. That's been added into the latest version.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, I did not see a new definition of legislative action, but I will read the existing definition of legislative action. And that means conduct relating to the development, drafting, consideration, sponsorship, enactment or defeat, support or opposition to or of a law, amendment, resolution, report, nomination, or other matters affected by legislative action or inaction. And part of the problem that we had with House Bill 44 and coming up with our alleged legal opinions was inaction. So if I'm chair of a committee and I have a conflict, holding the bill can be a ethics violation. So that's the reason why I have some problems with throwing legislative action back in here the way as it's defined, because you're kind of putting people in a sticky situation unintentionally again if they have a conflict. You act or you don't act, you're in trouble. So I just want to make sure that we're fixing this in this version.
Representative Tuck, through the chair, and the way that was solved, at least from the Senate's perspective, is if there was a conflict, which we have with Senator Hughes, the bill was discharged into another committee, and so that was the way that it was resolved. Well, that conflict is not going to exist under this definition. She'll be able to operate if she wants to reduce medical costs, and it affects her husband, who works at a clinic. If she if there's a tangential connection to the criminal justice reform because of therapeutic courts, which also have a contract with the clinic, she'll be able to operate. And under HB 44, she wasn't able to. But the way the Senate solved that is they had to discharge and juggle some of the legislative committees and the chairs in order to make sure that priority legislation was able to pass.
Okay, so if I see the fix is two-part, if I may, Mr. Chair. The two parts. First one is you make it so that it's no longer a conflict, and then the second part is if there is a conflict, you just work around your committees and just rearrange things as if you did in when we were under House Bill 44. So I see that's the two resolutions.
So part of the solution in this particular version was we had official influence already in the bill, which created a cloud. So legislative action is at least clearly understood that you're doing your legislative duties, and if you do have a conflict under these rules, then you need to declare it or stop acting. And so it's legitimate. We've made it very clear that it has to be so narrow that you are, in fact, getting a substantial benefit. And at that point, you are conflicted.
Okay, if I may, Mr. Chair, is that that's not how I remember in going over those advisory opinions, and we went over them and over and over in Ethics Committee. Official action was the big one. Mm-hmm. But official action was simple to solve because we have a definition for legislative action. So we relied on the definition of legislative action, which I don't see changing in this, when coming up with those ethics opinion. Now, official influence had to deal with who you talk to.
Right, exactly.
I'm okay with getting rid of that. I'm still back to legislative action and the problems that we're going to have with legislative action that I don't think this solves. And I drafted a version earlier in trying to fix all this stuff and just removing official action, official influence on that, so we can, and then defined when you can take action, that way to make it cleaner and clearer. I guess we can always work around whatever we have in statute, but if we're going to fix something, I think now's the time to try to fix it.
So in the context of the legislative action piece, I want to put two different hypotheticals out there. One, we've got a legislator whose spouse works for one of the regional native for-profit corporations, of which there are 12, and you've got a bill that affects all 12 regional native corporations equally. And that's scenario number one. Scenario number two is I actually think the scenario that we have now in Senate Bill 54 involving a transfer of railroad lands to a private enterprise that had purchased, and if my understanding of the history is correct, they basically got the descriptions wrong, so there's more land that still needs to get transferred to complete the transaction that they had agreed to. But that private enterprise, which let's assume it's held by a very small number of people, if and it's a single transaction involving that land, if one of the principal owners of that company was married to a legislator, how does that scenario differ from the 12 regional corporations in terms of whether that what that legislator could or couldn't do in each scenario with regard to, particularly with regard to drafting legislation or supporting legislation?
Representative Clayman, through the chair, the first scenario is not prohibited because it's a rising tide that floats all ships. It affects them all equally. And the second scenario, if it was a closely held interest, a private company and the spouse had a direct benefit, and that legislation specifically was focused on that, there could have been a benefit for the spouse, that would be prohibited. But you always have to go through the stepped analysis related to the language to see if that qualifies or not, which is it more likely than not? So I should restate that a little bit. If it's more likely than not that the spouse would benefit from the land transaction related to the railroad, and that qualifies in the sense that entity is receiving the benefit and other private entities may not. And then if they have an equity or ownership interest in that entity, then that would qualify for all three steps, and they would be prohibited from taking legislative action if that scenario were to occur. So that's the key distinction. You always have to go through those steps, go through the hurdles, and see if it is prohibited or not.
And follow up.
So I assume in that situation with the land transaction, the only thing that legislator could effectively do is vote to move it out of a committee that they weren't chairing or vote on the floor. But other than that, they would have to say, I have a financial interest in this, and so I've got a conflict and I can't do anything else. And that will steer clear. Somebody comes and wants me to lobby somebody. The answer is no, I can't do it.
Representative Clayman, through the chair, that is correct. And they would have to declare that conflict in the committee and on the floor.
And they may be excused. And I think to your point, both of you, we probably are entering into a time now where we have to start taking people's declarations seriously if we're going to define it so clearly. If they actually have that kind of a conflict, we may want to say let them off on the boat. The uniform rule requires that a city legislator is responsible to their specific district, and the interest that they have individually can be trumped by the district, but the individual can be excused from voting if that interest is so high that it's unreasonable or something like that. I can't remember the exact language, but in the uniform rule, Mason's rule, it says that it has to be overcome clearly. And so in the case that we've been dealing with for years, hardly ever have we seen a clear-cut case where they are going to either get a job, aggrandize a company, or themselves specifically. But this at least makes that clear. So,
if I may follow up on that one, Mr. Chair. Sure. So we really addressed the first part, and that is making it so people don't have a conflict. But when the scenario, because we really, well, I mean, we've lightened it up quite a bit from what we have right now. I mean, if you make more than $10,000 the previous 12 months, you have a conflict, you know, with and that's in what we have written now. And so now we're making it so that your conflicts are going to be reduced. But when you do have a conflict, we're basically tying that person's hands all the way for any type of legislative action. And I just want to make sure that everybody understands that that's what we're deciding to do with the way I see this being written.
Okay. Senator Biggs?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that point, that's exactly what we're doing, and I'm actually quite comfortable with tying our hands at that point. Right now, my hands are tied for everything when it comes to most education issues because my wife works for an entity that may or may not fall under a vague and ambiguous law. Now, when there's a piece of legislation that would materially benefit her employers or her, I will be prohibited from taking any action on it, and I should be. So for me, that's what it does, and I'm actually – I favor that. I favor that steeper restriction.
So just for clarity for those watching, we're dealing with two sections out of, I think, 12 in this particular section of law that are very clear, though. That is how to declare and when you have prohibited action. And these obviously have become the most testy spots of House Bill 44. This does not solve all the ethical questions we're ever going to have come before us, I can tell you that.
Yes, I realize that. And if I may, Mr. Chair, can someone give me an example of when somebody may have a conflict?
So,
I mean, a scenario. Not just you know, read me the
Senator Biggs was willing to.
I have one. Yeah, I think I could. Okay. So if in the Department of Education budget, prior to my wife being employed there was a clause that took a substantive amount of money in the Moore settlement and gave it to an organization that and this is all prior to my involvement. But had this happened now. If that money went to that organization, the Coalition for Education Equity, to pay for maintaining an element of the Moore lawsuit, which occurred prior to my service, I would be prohibited from voting on that legislation because it would materially benefit her. She gets an actual paycheck as a result of that activity, and I should be materially prohibited from voting on it, and I actually shouldn't vote. I'd probably get up and walk out of the legislature so I wouldn't vote on it. But that would be a very specific example where it could occur. A second example might be a cleanup contract that came before, a special contract perhaps that came, or a special piece of legislation for cleanup. And if you worked with a company that dealt with environmental cleanup, that would be a specific example that would be materially likely, the sole provider of that service, so they're materially likely to get that contract. You probably should not vote or sponsor a bill to do that and vote for it to do that if it would materially benefit your spouse who owns that company.
And so if I may, Mr. Chair, when we went through this through State Affairs, that's how we looked at official action, was not being able to vote, not be able to sign off on the bill being removed from committee, and having to declare and not being able to debate. And so And that's where we got in that pickle of official action, and then we got ourselves into more trouble by relying on legislative action. I'm okay with it. Everybody else is okay that action also includes inaction. And so I think we're actually going to be putting people back into the same spot if they have a conflict. And I'm okay with it. I just think that we can fix that part of it as well. But I'm okay with doing something because we're in a situation right now where we have to get, nobody can function with what we have on statutes right now.
True.
And I'd be more than happy to work with it a little bit further and trying to clean it up.
As I stated, this does not solve all questions. And this just tries to get us out of the situation where private meetings and broad conflict questions have come up that have really stifled good debate and hard work in the legislature to this day. And here we are bumping up on 100th day. So further discussion on this? I think it's good. We've got some of the intent of what we're trying to do out on the table. I'd entertain a motion then, Mr. Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the conference committee adopt the proposed CS-31-LS-0209-O as our working document.
Any objection? So the motion before the committee is adopt the committee report. Motion then will send the report to our respective bodies. And recommend. Oops. Oh, I'm sorry. I jumped the gun, didn't I?
You're here.
I'm sorry. I did jump the gun. I'm getting ready to move this thing, obviously. So we've had the discussion on the bill. Any further discussion? So, yeah. So I just thought I'd better ask for, since I'm already jumping the gun, any more discussion. So with that, then we have adopted the proposed CS and the free conference committee. So further discussion, guys? Sorry about that. It's Monday, you know, what can I say? I'm still thinking about grandkids. Mr. Klayman, I would entertain a motion then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the Free Conference Committee for Senate Bill 89 recommend that the House and Senate adopt the Free Conference Committee substitute version 31-LS0209-O with the accompanying zero fiscal note.
Any objection? I think we have to call a roll, don't we, on a free conference? So the motion before the committee is to send the report to our respective bodies recommending the approval of the conference committee. Secretary, please call the roll.
Representative Tuck.
Yes.
Representative Pruitt.
Yes.
Representative Klayman.
Yes.
Senator Stevens. Senator Begich.
Yes.
Senator Coghill.
Yes. Requires a majority vote of both sides, and so there being no votes, the motion is passed, and we'll send this to the respective bodies. So the motion passes. We'll send it on away. There being no further discussion or committee action, the conference committee is adjourned at 2:11.